It's Wednesday, December 13th, 2006, and you're listening to episode 30 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and with me is Chad.
Howdy!
And Adam.
Hi!
Okay, and like all...
Very lively, Adam. Excellent.
Thank you.
Like all of our best Fear the Boot stories, this one begins with Phil. So, now that it's December, here in America, it is that time of year when everyone is drug off to their obligatory office party for Christmas.
I missed mine.
Yeah, I wish I had missed mine. Actually, mine wasn't too bad, but I'll tell my story in a minute. But Adam, you brought us this little gem about Phil's office party.
I see, so you're going to make me tell it so I get in trouble.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So, Becky, Phil's wife, and Melina, my wife, are pretty close friends. So, they go out, and then they come back, and Melina comes back, and she's like, did you know what Phil did to Becky?
Always a great opener for a story.
This is clearly the best part, yes.
Seconded only by, Phil, can I see your character sheet?
So, she says, yeah, Phil went out last Thursday or so, and he told Becky, you know, me and Dave are going to go out to dinner.
Dave's his best friend, by the way.
We're going to go out to dinner, and I think we're going to do something afterwards. And she's like, all right, whatever. And I don't really care. So he goes out, and he comes back home. Maybe 2 days later, Becky finds out that Thursday was Phil's office Christmas party, and he took Dave as his date.
Never even told her. His own wife. I don't get it. Did we ever find out why?
You know, if
it is the enigma of Phil.
If Phil's taking a best friend to an office party, clearly... Becky has not drug him to enough weddings yet.
It's well.
See, the office party is your one opportunity for revenge.
Well, here's the question. It's like when they were at the office party, you know, he was going around with Dave and he's to his coworkers like, oh, Phil, where's your wife? Oh, she's at home. Well, who's this? This is my friend, Dave. Oh,
Dave's
really?
Not a looker either.
No. Well, neither's Phil, but...
Now, Chad, you were not able to find yours? Is that what happened?
Yeah. I don't know what happened. It was a place in downtown St. Louis called Windows Over Washington. I had never been there before. I couldn't print out the directions. There was something wrong with my printer. It was when I was leaving. I'm like, oh, man, I need to write down these directions. So I scribbled them down real quick. And I wonder if I wrote them down wrong too hastily or... I just missed the street. There's a street called 14th Street in St. Louis. I just drove all the way up and down it, all from one end all the way to the projects, all the way to the gravel pit where the bums hang out, all points in between. After driving up and down 14th Street for about an hour and not finding my cross street I needed, I'm just like, I'm going home.
I had a blast at mine.
Yeah, I know. I wish I would have. Adam and my office party were at the same time. I was half tempted to go over to the City Museum and crash it.
No.
I know. It would have been wild.
I don't really like office parties. And the reason is because when you go to these things, you're not exactly friends with anyone that's there. I mean, you might be. You might have some buddies at work. But for the most part, this is people you either don't know or maybe people that you enjoy working with, maybe. But it's not the kind of person you'd hang out with on a Saturday. And all of a sudden, here you are stuck at this party, the cocktail in your hand, standing around, trying to come up with polite conversation and look happy for the next 3 or 4 hours. And for someone like myself, who's fairly introverted, not a real big social butterfly to begin with, this is a terribly uncomfortable affair. Now, fortunately, I work with two guys that are friends of mine. In fact, we've been friends for the past long while. We actually had the previous job together as well. And so I kind of have a refuge when I'm at these things, but...
See, I was really disappointed that I missed mine, actually, because this is my first real job, my first real corporate job, and I have never done any of the corporate office thing. This is the first time where I have my own cube and my own drawers, my own desk, and I don't spend 8 hours standing on my feet, and I don't have to deal with customers and such. And I really want to get involved in the corporate life that you actually really hate, Dan, because you've been doing it for years. I've just have never done it before. And so I really wanted to go to the Christmas party.
You know what I would compare this to? As crazy as this sounds, I remember when I was growing up that my parents, of course, would always mow the lawn, and they would never let me mow the lawn at first. I'm serious. It's a true story. So to me, that became such a big people thing. And, oh, I want to mow the lawn. Yeah, we all know how that story ends.
Yeah.
So I see you going through the same thing with your office parties, that you're going to look forward to it just because you've never done it before.
Right.
And then you're going to do it, and you're like, oh, that's why people hate these things.
Yeah.
Open it's bar.
Tepid conversation.
A plus.
See, that's just it. My corporation is a lot bigger than yours, and they can't really have an open bar because it would cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars because there's
well, you never know, because they also make tons more money. I used to work for major corporations, and they did have open bars and such.
Mm-hmm.
Mine actually went fairly well once I got there. It was I called these buddies of mine. We kind of coordinated our arrival times to make sure we get there about the same time. It was just us and then one other couple at the table, and we're sitting there, and partway through the night, Carla starts talking about her coworkers at her company and mentions that she has a coworker who laughs like the succubus.
In World of Warcraft.
In World of Warcraft. Mm-hmm. Well, this guy says, hey, are you talking about World of Warcraft? And she's like, oh, no, don't tell me you play all these games. I'm like,
Carla. And you're like, oh, yes.
It's a computer company. Probably 50% of the people in here play World of Warcraft. And so we got to talking to this guy, worked from World of Warcraft to Dawn of War, from Dawn of War to 40K Tabletop. From 40K Tabletop, of course, you're easing your way through because you can't walk up to somebody and say, do you play D&D? But you can walk up to them and start talking about World of Warcraft. And
important social note here. You actually can walk up to a perfect stranger and ask if you play D&D. You shouldn't walk up to a perfect stranger.
It's kind of like walking up to a perfect stranger and saying, hey, is your wife a whore? It's just not something you're supposed to do. It breaks all kinds
of
social
taboos. It'll
be a
negative reaction.
Right. Yeah. Even if she is a whore.
You're right. Even if it's completely true. If you find someone who promptly admits, yes, my wife's a whore, you've probably walked into a situation you don't want to be in anyway, just like with D&D. So, but you can work from one topic to the next.
Dan at feartheboot.com.
Going down, you know, hey, World of Warcraft. Everybody plays World of Warcraft. And then go from there to, you know, Dawn of War, from Dawn of War to 40K, from 40K into, he starts talking about playing World of Darkness. So at this
point, you're just like, cha-ching!
Oh, yeah, at this point, I produce a Fear the Boot business card.
You chill.
There's only
awesome.
One other good thing that came out of it, which is our company being a pure consulting company, even though it's fairly small, it turns a pretty good profit. And so every year, they give us a check card with money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always pretty nice. They actually had a raffle, too, and I did win a prize, but I got up there too late, and I was not able to win the iPod. I was going to bring an iPod back to give away on Fear the Boot, because I don't really want an iPod personally, but they had an iPod.
Hell, I didn't
know
that contest.
Yeah, it didn't happen, though. I ended up with something else instead that's really not podcast relevant, so that didn't go too well.
Yeah.
Nice.
They gave out stuff at my work, too, and everyone was talking about what they won, and I'm just like, why weren't you there, Chad? Something came up.
You should say something like, because I hate all you assholes.
Yeah.
I'm here for the paycheck.
Nice.
Which is kind of how. Actually, I don't know. I like a lot of people I work with. It's just not.
You just don't like the corporate lifestyle.
No, I don't. I cannot stand the corporate lifestyle, all the politics and all the game playing and everything that goes into it.
I love the politics and the game playing.
I hate to say it. The more I am exposed to it, the more I like it.
I've got to. You know, we could do a whole bonus episode on this of what I think is wrong with corporate life. You know, really, I'd put as the capstone on that I'm okay with computer programming, but my ambitions are all creative. It's stuff like writing or Fear the Boot. I'd rather spend my time on that. In America, we just have an absolutely barbaric work schedule that, I mean, we work these hideously long weeks.
It could be like the fringe and only work 4 days a week and never get anything done.
Well, you know, and I realize there's an opposite extreme to this where you hit zero productivity. But if you look at most first world nations where they give you 4 to 8 weeks of vacation, this large number of holidays, and here in America, it's not uncommon to start a job and get tops 5 days off a year. It's not that uncommon.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm more of the American productivity hard work ethic, but I do think that there needs to be a national siesta.
I definitely heard him tell you that you don't have a hard work ethic.
I know. Well, I'm
I was definitely in there. Yeah. Did you see him trying to divert attention away with the siesta idea?
I work to live. I do not live to work. That's one of the big things.
That's because you're lazy and you hate Japanese people.
Yeah. I don't have time to defend that point, so I'll just agree with it and move on.
That's the Fear the Boot way.
Shadowrun sucks. Moving on.
All right.
To be compliant.
Quick follow-up on the open letter and bonus episode 11 that we just put out.
Yeah, let's keep it quick.
Yeah, we will keep it quick. First of all, I want to thank everyone that wrote in. After that, we had tons of people write in expressing their support for the show and support for what we do. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to do this. We do not make any money off this show. This is purely a labor of love. And what keeps us going is knowing that there are people out there that enjoy what we do and get something out of the show. So I really appreciate you guys taking the time to write in and tell us that. Also, we had a meeting this past Thursday, and we've worked out quite a few things that we think are going to help get this show back in the right direction.
Oh, boy, did we.
The only one that you guys really need to know about.
Chad is leaving the show.
Thank God. I've been trying to get that bastard off the show for 29 weeks.
It's awesome.
Chad's leaving the show. We are replacing him with a 12-inch tall Pee Wee Herman doll that has one of those pull strings on the back and says various things.
Oh, yeah. We won't notice much difference.
Well, the voice is a little bit deeper.
Fuller.
That's, sir, sign language on a podcast. Yeah, here it is.
The one-finger wave. But the one thing you guys do need to be aware of is that moving forward, we actually had listeners suggest to us that we move the show later in the week, partially because it gives us more time to prep the show. Because right now we do record on Saturday, edit on Sunday, release on Sunday night, Monday morning, which gives us no time if anything goes wrong. So they suggested, look, move the show to Wednesday because that gives you guys two more days to play with. And also, right now, every podcast out there just about releases its content on Monday.
And we are elitists, so...
We are elitists who...
Monday is not good enough for us.
If Monday's what the commoners can use, it will not work for Fear the Boot. We must forge a way forward.
Dan!
No.
At feartheboot.com.
In all seriousness, what it's... If we put it on Wednesday, it just helps spread the content out a little better through the week.
And we are elitists.
And that's what these guys were saying. Say, you know, look, we listen to all our favorite podcasts on Monday. We'd rather hear some on Monday, some of them throughout the week. So we're going to start releasing on Wednesday morning to spread things out. We're also hoping to get a show in the hopper so we have not just half a week, but indeed a week and a half of play. So as things go wrong in our lives, which is just the way lives go, we aren't going to put you guys in a position where you're going to be without an episode for a week again. Xbox Live Contest is in its final week. We have given away the Need for Speed Most Wanted. I still have left Burnout Revenge and the Xbox Live Arcade Unplugged. There has been a winner this week for one of these two games, but I've not yet heard back from him on which of these two games he wants, so I can't tell you which one's left. But through this last week, go to feartheboot.com/contest or use the contest entry form link at the top of our site. As we said on our front page blog, you do not need an Xbox Live gamer tag to win anymore. Poetry contest, Adam, that actually ended last week, but we didn't have an episode, so...
had a winner.
Good.
Entry number 3. I believe the title was Every Host That Rises by Fury O. Booter.
I thought it was entry 2. I don't know. 2 or 3.
Well,
the titles, the title and the name is correct.
It is an easy winner.
It was
winner.
The long one.
It was an easy winner. It was a definite stroke to the host, so.
It certainly was. Although, but I think you were the only host that actually voted.
I was the only host that actually voted. I liked it because it was a funny poem, and I have no idea who posted it, because it was all anonymous.
Yeah, so. I didn't vote at all. Same thing, I have no idea who the entrants are.
I didn't get the memo that we weren't supposed to vote. So.
Yeah.
No. I said everybody could vote, except I wouldn't vote because I know who the entrants are.
Chad,
and if the entrant would like to claim their prize, they can go ahead and post in that thread to identify themselves.
Getting back to the content for the game design series, we got a voicemail that I want to talk about real quick. And as a quick aside, you guys, of course, know you can get to us through the forums or through the email or through the blog post. But just to let you know, we actually have tons of ways you can reach us. We have a phone number that goes to a voicemail box. We even actually have a number you can call to listen to the show. Or like if you call this phone number, it's like a 510 number, you can listen to the entire current show over your phone. And I think what I'm going to try to do this week is consolidate all that stuff and put it all on the contact form on our website. So if you go to feartheboot.com, click the contact link, we'll put it all there. But we got a voicemail in that box from Sam Chupp, who is the host of the Bears Grove podcast over at bearsgrove.com. And Sam used to work for White Wolf, doing Vampire the Masquerade and all the World of Darkness type stuff. And Sam was talking to us a little bit about the inside stuff that goes on, you know, when his company was making role-playing games. And I say was, I mean, when he was still working there. Right. I'm under the impression he doesn't work there right now. He mentioned that they actually had a field document exactly like what we're talking about, or we talked about in the last episode.
It wasn't called a field document.
Yeah, they had
something else.
It's like nice to have validation.
It is, yeah, actually. And it was called a theme document. But he was talking about the difficulty of actually implementing that document, that he agreed it was very critical, but there are some potential pitfalls in implementing it. For example, you may give out the field document to your various team members, like your artists and such, and they misinterpret it, or they ignore it. Or as you develop the game, things related to that field document change.
Yeah.
Or they read the field document but take it too hyper-literally. Mm-hmm. And you get this almost like cookie-cutter sort of art that really doesn't actually communicate the feel, even though it perfectly fits the feel.
And we're going to put that audio or voicemail?
It's a voicemail. It's a WAV file, I believe.
We're going to put that up on our... Yeah.
Yeah. So if you guys want to hear that, it's really interesting stuff. We have Sam's permission to post that up. Stop by at feartheboot.com, and on the front page blog where we have the show notes for this episode, we are going to post a link to that voicemail. So I would highly recommend, if this kind of thing really interests you, stop by and take a listen to that. It's really good stuff. And a big thanks to Sam for sending that our way.
Mm-hmm.
For today's episode, we are going to try and knock down two topics related to game design. And depending on how long we go on the first, we may or may not get to the second. If we don't get to the second, no big deal. It's not like this show is on a limited run, so we'll just pick it up next time. But the first one we want to talk about is something that I would put in a similar category to feel. Because while I think there's a lot of work that is put into this, I still think it's one of the underappreciated concepts of role-playing design. And I think most people understand it, but they don't really stop and consciously think about it. It's just sort of a something you do implicitly rather than explicitly. And what we're talking about is character role. And by character role, we mean exactly what it is within your role-playing game that the typical character is supposed to be or is supposed to do. And more specifically, these are the things that your rules and fluff meaning your backstory and little sidebar short stories and all these things, either emphasize or enable. Now, I know at this point someone could say, well, wait a minute, it's a role-playing game. I should be able to play anything at all that the setting supports, which is true. But when you put out a role-playing game book, either through the art or backstory, you are going to emphasize certain kinds of characters, or through the rules, you are only going to enable certain kinds of play. Let's take D&D. All right, within D&D, let's say that I want to play a peasant who lives on a farm who doesn't kill any dragons or adventure around. Well, simply put...
Well, why would you want to play that?
Well, simply put, there is no...
You know, actually, yeah, that is kind of a valid question.
Why would you want to play a peasant and play D&D?
Well, but keep in mind, I'm responding here to the theoretical argument, shouldn't a role-playing game allow everything?
Okay.
So I'm starting with the, and I agree with you, but that's kind of the point of role, is that role is supposed to dictate what it is you're supposed to be in this game. So,
okay, so role is almost the scope of what you are willing to cover with your rules in the game.
Right, exactly. So,
and not just rules, but...
Well,
all of
everything.
It.
Everything.
Rules,
story, art, even.
Let's take D&D. When you pick up D&D, if you look at any of the given settings, they talk a lot about the knights and the wizards and the adventurers and the thieves guild. Outside of mentioning they're there, you don't get a huge amount of development for what farm life is like. Similarly, when you pick up the player's handbook and you flip through that, what you're seeing is pictures of guys smashing skeletons, character classes for fighters and wizards.
You do see a farm field. And you see guys smashing skeletons on farm fields.
But there's nothing really there to encourage, enable, emphasize, whatever word you want to use, a non-combat style of play.
I can accept that.
Yeah, I think within a role-playing game, it is, going back to that statement I made, it's sort of subconscious desire to want to enable anything. But I really don't think it's actually wise to do.
It's almost getting to the point where you're just trying to generalize your rules too far out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think it gets back to a simulationist thing, where a simulationist's goal is not to bend the rules to get whatever you want. A simulationist's goal is to
have the functionality to allow that.
Yeah,
to any situation that
to
you
where
want.
It's realistic, and even not to a point of rules from a game design perspective. Again, the rules, the story, the fluff, the art to create a reality to where you can have character roles that operate within this reality, that don't try to go below it to where you're playing a high adventure fantasy and then it all that stuff allows for peasants, because that's going too low toward that one goal that you're setting, or too high to where you play the dragon king god that consumes the earth with, you know, do whatever. That goes way too above the scope of what the game is trying to do. Now, if players want to play that within your setting, there's nothing you can do to stop them.
Nothing you should
do to stop them. But you should set that bar. You should set that scope. And it's either a very narrow scope, which can become too narrow, where players can only have a limited role within the universe, again, defined by rules and setting and art and all that stuff. Or you can have a very wide scope, and which, again, allows for the peasant.
Right.
Or
I think
the Dragon King.
If a game designer tries to allow everything, you hit two problems. One is balance. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about balance in more detail a little bit later. But also, you just can't cover it all. I mean, yeah. You can't have rules and backstories for everything. And if you do, it almost, you hit this danger that your game quickly loses focus and purpose.
Yeah.
That you're developing everything a little bit instead of developing a few things a lot.
Unless you have a game whose feel is an anything goes sort of feel. Like this, say your
Which
game feel is just
you,
this outrageous high fantasy.
Right. And I guess you could do that, but it's the point you'd hit is, you know, you have to accept as part of that feel that all these things will be developed insufficiently.
Yeah.
They're just going to be developed enough to do them.
And I feel as well that if your game feels one of those anything goes fantasies, the role and scope of the characters is up. Power, 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 or even just an expansiveness of character, and it's very rarely goes the other way.
Yeah, I can see that.
My advice to a game designer is this role is there in your game, whether you want it to be or not. Mm-hmm. Because the simple fact of the matter is, as you write things, there are a certain number of roles in the world that you are bringing up. And as you put the setting in front of people, there are a certain number of roles that these people are going to be attracted to. So this intention of role is there. You might as well be honest about it and take some amount of control over it. And the way that you put forward that role, and we've talked about how the art implies it, much like feel. If you have pictures of people doing certain things, that implies these are the things they can or should do in your game. The backstory, if you have supporting fiction or historical write-ups on various places, the kinds of things you talk about are pushing people towards a role. The rules, you look at the D&D's Player's Handbook. I can find you in that thing tons and tons and tons of rules about killing stuff.
Right.
I cannot find you one page of rules on the details of farming.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to kill something, we've got tons of detailed combat rules. If I say, look, I'm going to do a turnip haul.
Yeah, it's roll a D20 your farm. On your profession, yeah. Right in the profession skill.
You rolled a total of 22. You had a pretty good harvest. Congratulations. And then you move on with the game.
And the game master, of course, this gets into another aspect of it. The game master can always fluff it up and rules it up. And there's always supplements you can get to build it up. The farming aspect or the whatever aspect, the game doesn't let you have to change the game. If that's an important part of your game and you're changing the game to fit that, why are you playing that game? Why don't you just write your own game?
Yeah.
And as an aside, that's kind of where, like, Dan and I, when we were coming up role-playing as teenagers and stuff, that's why we started writing our own games, is because no game was ever good enough. Not because we were some elite super gamers, but because we always wanted something more.
Or something different,
than
what the game allowed.
And then we were always tweaking games, always changing games, and then we just said, why don't we just write our own game?
And one thing that's important to keep in mind here is the difference as we work through this is, and this is, Chad, kind of something you're getting towards, we are not talking about what the players can do with the game.
Right.
Because as we keep saying, the players can do anything. And in our gaming advice, we encourage that.
Yeah.
But we are talking instead, because this is a design series, what it is as a designer, you're intending the players to do and enabling them to do.
Right. We always had a saying back in the day when we would take D&D and we would make changes to it. Some rules lawyer friend would be like, well, you can't do it. That's not in the rules. And we were like, what, is Gary Gygax going to come to our house and break our kneecaps?
Yeah. Now, we talked about some of the ways that role can be expressed, but one of the things we have not hit just yet, and I think this is a big sticking point, let's look at D&D. You want to know what your roles are in the game. You don't have to look at rules or setting or pictures. You can go straight to character classes.
Mm-hmm.
The character classes tell you what it is you are meant to be in the world. There's a reason why you'll find rules for fighter and wizard and cleric, and you will not find rules for an artisan. I realize there's quick rules in the DM's guide, but I'm talking about a serious character
right.
section. There's a reason why it doesn't exist.
You will never see a D&D main book with a farmer on the front.
Well, you know what? I think that is exactly what D&D is supposed to be. I mean, take your character classes.
Mm-hmm.
That is what you are supposed to be.
Yeah.
You are supposed to be those things. So why would they have rules for things
exactly.
that those people
well,
don't
it,
do?
You see, that's that scope we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
The role... The role of your player's scope for D&D And even all the settings in D&D is set at a certain level where it tops out
at
a certain point.
The field is adventuring.
Yeah, and it bottoms out at a certain point. That bottom out is not a peasant. And no. The top is not necessarily a god. I mean, you can kind of go there, but...
Let's talk about how the character classes within a game can help the game and some of the problems that they create as well. So we can try and give some sort of evaluation of what the pros and cons are of using character classes to define roles.
Well, I think that templates are great because it's going to tell you how the rules are going to impact your character.
I think it's also good to get somebody started quickly. Mm-hmm. That when you pick up a game, one of your first questions is, well, what kinds of things can I be? And a character class is a really fast introduction to that. And even more so, and I don't mean to just play these off as, oh, well, this is just what the simpletons use. But if you're new to role-playing, one of the first questions is, well, what am I supposed to do in this game? Yeah. And a lot of people cannot handle the idea you can be and do anything. And so I think it helps to have, well, here's these things you can pick from.
Right. It's also good from a game designer standpoint, too, because when you're establishing your feel and you're asking yourself, well, what is the role? How do I present to the players what the players, generally speaking, should be doing in their game? Game designers can just say, well, character classes. You fit in the roles of fighter, healer, damager, you know, mage, rogue type thing, or class buffer, or whatever.
You know, and speaking of which, while this podcast doesn't generally suggest min-maxing, it does help with group balance. That if you're playing a game that is more combat-centered, this does help you make sure you have all the important roles represented so you can succeed when you go out and do what the game is meant to enable, which is killing dragons or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. Easy NPCs also. You yeah, want to know what's in the
exactly.
world? You know, something you mentioned also is implied setting. That what you see in the character classes tells you what's out there in the world.
Right.
That if you see a mage character class, obviously you learn magic somewhere, so there must be...
So obviously there's fantasy and magic in the game.
Right, and possibly a mage academy yeah. or an old wizard who teaches people these things or something.
And even within most games, the vast majority of games I've seen, even the games that are like purely combat-driven games, the character classes tend to have some sort of fluff written into them. And that fluff helps define not only the role of the class, generally what they do, but also helps establish the feel and the setting and sometimes even the history of the story.
Now, some of the problems with character classes is, first thing, is they kind of box up and limit what you can be. That
definite pigeonholing.
D&D has kind of gotten around this a little bit with multi-classing and dual-classing, and I realize they've done away with some of those in third edition, but you can't really kind of pick and choose what you are. That you are A or B or C, and if you want to be kind of, well, a half A, a half B with maybe a little sprinkling of C, once again, outside of the multi-classes, you really can't do that. Mm-hmm. You have to fit these certain pigeonholes. And also, just as we talked about implied setting, there's an implied character.
Right.
That even though the game does not tell you that if you're a thief, you have to be the high dexterity, mediocre charisma, shady guy yeah. with a shady... It's implied, and that's what people tend to play.
Or the warriors, the big, dumb, strong guy who's really slow and both right. in speed and in intelligence. I think that you can think of character classes like stereotypes. You don't have to play them that way. It's just an implication that comes part and parcel with the character classes, with how the fluff. I mean, they can only write the fluff for a character class once in one way. You don't want to have, well, this is a fighter. Now, for the next 15 pages, we're going to have 28 different unrelated stories on all different 28 kinds of fighters.
Right.
Not a cool thing.
Yeah, here's the big dumb prick. Here's the dashing swashbuckler. Here's mm-hmm. the humble servant of the people. Right.
Yeah.
And something to keep in mind is that even if your game does not have character classes, you still, in a sense, are putting forward some kind of a role just because of the fact that your rules are going to support something and not support something else. Let's talk real quick about where role can go wrong, not character classes anymore.
Dan, what is... Now, I might be getting ahead of us here since I don't read the outlines.
Excellent.
But,
jerk.
What are the alternatives to a character class?
Let's really boil a character class down to something. A character class is, number one, what your character is supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
and number two, what they're capable of.
For example, of killing.
If we look even like, let's take Vampire the Masquerade, where you don't have exactly character classes, you have races.
Yeah, or clans or races.
Yeah, clan,
or
however you
concepts,
want.
Yeah.
And even still, what do those things have? Well, you have a certain certain role you have to play, and you've got certain powers you have and powers you're restricted from and politics you must conform to. So it still basically sets the same kind of thing. And I think if you're going to find a way around character class, all you really can do is find some other way to define those things, what you are and what you do, or what you do and what you're capable of. Most games would do that with an open skill system, or they might do it with a point system, where here's a list of powers. Imagine a D&D game. In fact, actually, I think in second edition, there was an alternate character creation system in some expansion rule book where you took points. Each level of armor was worth a certain number of points. Casting arcane spells was worth a certain number of points. And it was like so many points make up a character, and then you could spend those however you want. As I said a minute ago, in most games that are going for something a little bit more down to earth than that, they just tend to use a skill system.
Right.
Or maybe supplement with a feat system or a perks and flaws system.
One system that you guys always talk about is the Star Trek system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've used that principally in all of your examples talking about this podcast, but have not once mentioned it on this podcast.
Well, you know, the fastest Star Trek game did,
which is wonderful, by the way.
Yeah, I love that character creation system. Is your template, so to speak. And of course, this game got off easy because really what it was meant to enable was people working for Starfleet.
Right.
So you had some position on the ship. And within that, they could say, you know, well, everyone on a Starfleet vessel has in common the fact that they went through Starfleet Academy.
Yeah.
And so what they did instead was your role, so to speak, was defined by
your educational
yeah. path. And so they could walk you through, if you went to this kind of school, this is what happened.
If you're a
These
navigator,
were the skills you got.
Yeah, if you're the ship's navigator, when you make your character class, you go through Starfleet Academy, because everybody goes through the academy. Then you go through a specialty school, and you go through like helm and navigation school. And if you're an officer, then you go through the officer school. And each step of the way, you mark it off on a chart how many years you spent there. You get a certain amount of skill packages from going to that school.
And there are some electives and such in there.
Yeah,
so.
And some elective stuff. And so you can customize it, and it gives you the grade.
Yeah, it actually tells you how you
roll
did.
For your how well you did. And then from there, it goes into your cadet crews.
Right.
And you roll to see what kind of cadet crews you have. Like, you could be the lowliest merchant marine crap job all the way to the Constitution class ship, which is sort of like the Enterprise. And you're doing galaxy exploration. Then there's all sorts of colony command, tactical right. command. And you roll on that. And then you roll what kind of grade. And you could pass or fail. And when you failed, you have to do another one. But that adds years to your life.
And the neat thing about the way that they kind of walked you through this is the fact that since you were ending up on a Starfleet ship, you probably had a role in mind already.
Mm-hmm.
And so that educational path and that life path could take you there. But I want to talk extensively about life paths when we get to our episode on character creation, yeah. how you build a character system.
We're going to have to do some studying up on that one.
Yeah.
People on our forums, we kind of hit on that a little bit on our forums, and they're like, oh, you guys got to check out the Traveler system, because the Traveler system has this whole huge life path thing, and Star Trek has a life path thing. So,
and I like life paths. I could be wrong, but I foresee us at least trying to accomplish that in Skies of Glass.
I like life paths over character classes, but I think that you have to be careful with them, because there comes a point to where I don't want the roles and the charts and the character creation system to define every single aspect of my character.
Oh, right, exactly. But
so
we see eye to eye there.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that in a relevant episode. Let's talk about where role can go wrong, the kinds of pitfalls we've seen games fall into. Number one, biggest peeve of ours is they are all centered around killing.
Yep.
And now I realize for some games that may be appropriate. If you're playing a game about special forces or about adventurers going out killing dragons, obviously having huge detailed rules for farming simply isn't appropriate.
Yeah. You're playing the special forces Iraq mission game, you know, and the whole point of the game is to play soldiers. Yeah, you'll have character classes, and those character classes will be, you know, the different MOSs or whatever they're called.
They need to have a basket weaving skill.
Yeah.
The fat Polish baker really has no role in this game.
Exactly.
And we also realize that for some people, this just may not be what they want out of a game. But as we look through the role-playing games that we own quite a few titles. I have not found a single game yet, once again, of the ones I own, that really enables and encourages a detailed play of a character class that is not about killing. I've seen them as afterthoughts. Like, you can look at Rifts, and in Rifts, you have these super-powered character classes like the Glitter Boy and whatever, and you have all these rules on mega damage and killing people and this, and smashed somewhere between them is like one or two pages on playing a historian.
Right, and even then, the historian OCC has a picture with it of a guy reading a book, holding a gun and looking real menacing. It's like, yeah. You know, and
there's no fluff to support it. There's no rules to enable it. Yes, you could be imaginative and make up your own kind of game about a historian, but what you're doing is you're forging new territory. This is not what the game shipped with.
That's not to say that there aren't any games out there like that.
We're just saying
not ones that we haven't seen. And I will say that I think White Wolf goes really far to allow a person to play a non-combat character. You can make a combat, you can make a non-combat character White Wolf. You could play a club owner who's really weak, doesn't have any gun skills, and has all these perks and flaws and advantages and skills that allow them to have contacts and a deep character and stuff. But don't get me wrong, Vampire the Masquerade also has very heavy rules on killing.
Right.
Because you're playing vampires.
Well, you pick a Vampire the Masquerade, there's no question here. You're meant to play a vampire.
Right.
You could play a human who has no contact with vampires.
But that's a different supplement.
Do with vampires.
It's a different game.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's not the same game
anymore.
You can
play a ghost, but again, that's a different supplement. So, that's a different game.
First pet peeve is we wish there was a little bit more variety out there where you could play something in a game that doesn't constantly involve murder.
Yeah. Where the game supports that. Again, we're not saying, well, I could play D&D and I can make my own rules and own class. No, we're talking about game design series here. We're talking about the game itself. It supports that in the rules, in the crunchy number rules, supports non-killing things.
Something else I've seen is games that have cool stuff in the setting, but they do not have sufficient rules to support the play.
Mm-hmm.
That they develop a really interesting, unique role, but there is absolutely nothing in the game to support playing it. So you can be like, man, I'd really love to play this, you know, this thing right here, but there's nothing there for it.
Yeah.
You have an example?
Well, I think one example you can see is going back to D&D. If you look at what became the really popular fan-based character classes that eventually found their way into supplements, then found their way into the game, like the Barbarian or Monk, those represent things where there was obviously some opportunity in the setting that people were seeing that they just couldn't express. There wasn't the rules there to do it.
I think another one is like Shadowrun, for instance. I know you have your corporate man example, so I won't rip that one off. But like in Shadowrun, there's all these dragons, and the dragons play an important political part, and they're very integrated into the story and such, but you can never play one.
Yeah, you can't play one. There's really no rules for even playing someone that associates with them or knows what's going on with them. And once again, there may be kind of little supplements along the way that pick these things up, but in that main core of rules, they don't really explore them.
Even in the novels, you know, their characters in the novels, they have a book called Never Deal with a Dragon or Never Make a Deal with a Dragon, which is all about how you should never deal with one because they'll screw you over, not how to actually play one and interact with it meaningfully.
I've also seen a lot of games where the rules aren't balanced. And if you're talking about a combat game, that's pretty simple. That Class A and Class B just cannot carry the same weight or purpose in combat.
Right.
But even in games that are not that combat-centered, you can just talk about how much is there for them to really do.
Right.
Have you written a lot of supporting fluff to explain this is what their lives are like? Have you written in enough rules to make their lives just as complex as everyone else's? Adam's always talking about the bard this way. We talked about
the bard.
We talked about the historian in Rifts being this way, that there's nothing in there on what you would do as a historian, really.
You can make all that up, but the game doesn't make it up and doesn't support that.
Same thing with the farmer in D&D. Now, the farmer is not an intended role in D&D.
Yeah.
But let's say it was. Well, you would now want rules that are just as complex for bringing in a potato crop as you have for bringing in a dragon's
head. But like in Rifts, the historian is an intended role. Because it's a character
class.
Yeah,
and I agree with you, and they're just...
No, it's not an intended role.
It's an intended NPC.
It's an intended NPC. It's not something that they expect you to play.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about, then kind of wrapping this one up, what we intend to do for Skies of Glass, what our take is going to be on role. And as we say with all these topics, first of all, these are choices we're making for our game. That does not mean, therefore, these are the right choices. These are just the right choices for our game.
No, they're
And our game is going to be the best game.
Secondly, I'll let Chad at FearTheBoot.com.
Oh, yeah.
I can handle that one.
Well, it's definitely going to be better than Shadowrun.
So. We'll discuss that one later. Secondly, we are also going to put something up on the resources section of our site where we will detail kind of what the sorts of roles we have in mind for Skies of Glass are. So be sure to go by and check that out. But what we are going to do in Skies of Glass, we came up with a couple bullet points to kind of talk about the roles we have in mind for characters within our game. And based on that, this is where we are going to focus our rules and our fluff as we develop the game. So first of all, the first point we came up with is we generally mean for these characters to be people of small influence.
Right.
Now, while we are not going to stop you from playing the governor of some 100-mile-wide empire, we are not going to have rules in there that support the management of an empire.
Right.
We are going to focus our rules on people that are either lone adventurers, heads of family, maybe mayors of small settlements. We are not going to dig into the really deep...
The movers and shakers are setting... Not
right.
Character class.
It's not intended for people to play. We're not going to have rules on balancing tax rate versus happiness. And
I love Civilization.
We probably could release the Civilization scenario for Skies of Glass. But second thing we said is that we intend for people to generally be playing someone surviving out on the land. The game will support playing someone who lives in a settlement. So see, this kind of is a little bit. There's a little bit of give here. What we are not intending is if we leave any cities that are kind of like these great big last refuges of mankind where they have perfect technology and electricity and running water and 21st century technology, we're really not writing enough for you to play in those cities. We are intending that even if you're from one of those cities, this game is going to take place out in the settlements of the wilderness, out in the badlands of mankind. The third thing that we said is we want to really support all the kinds of rules we could see springing up within this that we want to allow equally both combat and non-combat characters. So we will have good detailed rules in there. If you're out as a vigilante or even just dealing with the raiders who show up on your farm, you're going to have the rules in there to have fairly accurate detailed combat. But we also want to create the game so that what really interests you is merchanting or surviving or agrarian life, that there are at least enough rules there so that you can play these roles as well and have a very fulfilling game where you very rarely, if ever, pick up your gun.
Mm-hmm.
Something we should probably talk about is how we arrived at these roles. Because we're sitting here talking about, well, we want you to play survivalist, not somebody from one of these last holds of mankind. How did we come to that? One thing to keep in mind that's very important that actually Adam was expressing here before the recording is that the role that characters are going to play actually is a continuation of feel.
Mm-hmm.
That if you said in your feel document you were trying to get forward that this is a post-nuclear survivalist game, when all of a sudden you create a series of roles for people who have no such struggles in their lives,
right,
suddenly you just devoided that setting and that game experience of its intended feel. So you have to keep your eyes on the fact that role really pours right out of feel. What kind of roles do people have to play to really give them a sense of this feel you're trying to capture in your world? Looking at the clock, we got a couple minutes left. Not enough time to jump into backstory and history.
Yeah. We could, but I want to really short that.
Right. I want to be sure we do it justice. Why don't we take this opportunity, use the next few minutes to answer some of the questions that we have been asked about Skies of Glass on our forums. All right, let's tackle one of the ones that's feel related. Someone said to us, given the fact that this is a post-nuclear setting and there's going to be all these problems and dangers, and it's a big, you know,
it's a survivalist game.
Is this going to be a too depressing game? All this is about suffering? And the answer to that is no. While we want there to be elements of struggle in your daily life, we do not intend to make the game just this depressing, horrific experience. Like every morning you wake up and make a save versus cholera.
Well, I think it's important enough that that isn't what everything is about. So important that we actually put it in the field document.
Right.
Right.
Hope is a major player in this game.
Right. That we want to put into the backstory that, yeah, there are corrupt societies and people doing evil things, but there are also good societies. There are people doing good things. Mm-hmm. There are people that are building functional, working, new cultures trying to find a way forward. And that your role within the game is going to be somewhat defined just by the campaign your game master creates, but that ultimately you have the ability to go out into the world and to succeed at what you're attempting to do.
And this is something that we're we're just not going to assume, but as game designers, we are going to work into the game to give game masters and players the sense that there is going to be hope in the game, and there is hope in the overall story
and
think their stories.
Part of what we have to do with that is we have to make sure that none of these survival obstacles are so high that, at least on average,
right,
that it becomes the focus of all you do. That while, you know, there may be food scarce in some places, in most places there is sufficient stuff to eat. While there may be diseases out there, it's not like where you go, everyone's rotting away. While there may be hostile nomads, it's not as if everywhere you go, you're just running scared from bands of nomads you can't possibly succeed against.
There are obstacles out there, and that's where the suffering comes in. But you play a normal guy. You don't play some action superhero god with laser beams out your eyes. And again, combine that with suffering, you have a depressing game. The hope comes in is that you're an average guy, and when you're faced with that suffering, you can overcome it. That's where the hope comes
in. Right, exactly. That's very well put, and that's exactly right. Similarly, someone asked us kind of what the point of a person within the world is. Like, what does the character do? And this fits right into the role conversation we're having right now. He said, you know, look, what is this about? Do I just run scared from one place to the next, roaming through the radioactive waste, fleeing mutants to some massive, unstoppable governmental organizations out to get me? And the answer is absolutely not.
I won't make many bold statements. No mutants.
Yep.
Oh, none of like the three-armed laser beam eye type.
I said no mutants.
You would be wrong.
I said no mutants.
Okay. You can say no psionics.
I will say no psionics.
Excellent.
Okay, and we will accept that. But the answer is no. That really what you are trying to do is the fact that a nuclear war happened sets the scene. It does not create the game. We do not therefore fill the game with all these stereotypical things related to nuclear war, like mutants and horribly corrupt governments that bought police and all these kinds of things. The point of this is you have now been reduced to effectively a frontier setting.
Right.
And what you are trying to do is you are trying to have a successful life within that frontier setting. That may be living quietly in a town. That may be working as a merchant. That may be working as a bounty hunter. It could be any number of things.
That may be, on the other side, you're a bandit.
Yeah, you are a bandit who's trying to survive off of, by preying on society. Ultimately, we are trying to build more of a frontier feel within a post-nuclear
setting. There's lawlessness and disorder.
And there's also lawfulness, just depending on the place you go.
And order, and sometimes over-order. Well, Dan, let me ask you this question. Is this a type of game where, generally speaking, the adventures are located in one area and the players, whatever role they choose, have those adventures within that area, within the town, the county, the sort of surrounding areas? Or is this an adventure where you travel from place to place and see new and exciting places and have adventures along the way, and adventures when you get to those places and then move on?
You know, I'd say this is the kind of game that's probably going to enable either style, but this really goes the reverse direction of most role-playing games, where what we are kind of spinning the game to do is actually to occur fairly locally.
Right.
That you pick a life that you're going to fit into. You know, you're going to have the rules so that if you want to settle down and run some kind of a workshop or run a farm, and hopefully if we can get what we want out of this game, if we succeed, you have enough rules to make that interesting. Mm-hmm. And the setting will be detailed enough that it's not like, I mean, in most games you have to wander from place to place because there's only a couple interesting things in each town. So you kind of go and you squeeze out those interesting things and move on. We hope to keep the setting detailed enough that you don't really need to wander from place to place to find more to do. Now, if you can if you want to, though. Well, and also this kind of figures into the organization we have in mind where we're going to release this game by regions. Mm-hmm. So if you want to travel 1,000 miles in the first book, you probably can't do that. You just won't know what's out there until we release that source book. We will still allow that kind of travel. I mean, there's nothing to stop it. In fact,
there's no magic force field that prevent you from going somewhere.
And I want to emphasize that a lot of things we're saying right now, these are just what we're thinking right now. We are re-envisioning this game. We're not just writing down a game we've always known. We are kind of scrapping and re-envisioning a lot of it. So if we say something today and then tomorrow at release, you know, tomorrow, but a year from now or whatever.
Prices are subject to change.
At least, all this stuff could change. This is just what we sitting here, right now, want to do. But getting back to traveling, one of the things I would like to do is to have at least a baseline economy. So if you want to be a merchant, you can actually know how to get things from one place and go to another. Or if you want to be someone who's fairly lawless or a bounty hunter who needs to go from place to place, that we've described enough things along the way that you can still have an interesting adventure as somebody who moves about.
Right.
But really, the game is more spun towards people that either stay in one town or maybe run a circuit within several towns that are all right within an area. Say maybe a space the size of like an average U.S. state, mm-hmm. for example. You know, I think this question answer thing at the end is kind of working out. It's working out pretty well.
Yeah, I really like it.
All right,
because a lot of people have questions about. They ask us, like, okay, what is Saw or Skies of Glass? You said Skies of Glass is a post-nuke survivalist game.
What does that really mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, you know what? I was over at one of the guys on the forums house last night, and he started asking questions, and I was like, I don't know!
All right, do you know what we're going to do outside of give Adam ghost lessons?
More chains, less...
From now on,
that was my mysterious
throughout the design series... We're going to start making this like a regular 5 or 10 minute segment at the end of the show,
right?
Where we will answer your guys' questions. So if you have any
questions specifically about Skies of Glass,
well, Skies of Glass and also whatever it is we're talking about. So if you guys have any questions about Skies of Glass, don't hesitate to email us or post it on the forums and we will try and answer those. Now, a couple things. First of all, we will have to get to those as we cover the show material. So if you shoot way ahead of us to some future topic, like you say, well, gee, how are you going to market this game?
That's later.
Great question.
Yeah.
Come back in a couple months. Also, speaking of which, at this point, I realize one of the first things people want to know about is rules. And I don't have a problem with that because I myself am a pretty crunchy mm-hmm. rule man.
I'm not.
But please understand, rules is probably going to be 1 to 2 months away from now because we have to get through a lot of other soft material like story and setting before we can get to rules. So if you send in rules questions, just hold on because it may be a while before we get to those. In fact, just to make sure I don't forget, you may want to hold those questions until we get closer to rules. So for now, focus on stuff that's related to feel, history, setting, player role,
any questions,
the things we've talked about so far.
Yeah, any questions you have regarding Skies of Glass, they could even be super, super general ones like Skies of Glass history. Go. You know, that's a valid question. I don't know if we'll answer it, but that's a valid question. Even to super, super specific questions like, I live in Gatlingsburg. What are you doing with Gatlingsburg? Does a nuke drop on it? You know, and we may not answer that question, but we might produce a list of cities that got nuked and didn't get
nuked. We'll have a nuke lottery. Yeah. Everyone working with their hometown will draw one that gets nuked.
Oh my God, what a great idea.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.